Thank you, dear. Dear, I love you, and I'm very grateful to be here this morning. My name is Joe, and I am a grateful recovering alcoholic. And I'm a member of the Skyland Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. My sobriety date is March the 1st of 1949, for which I am deeply grateful. And to be in this place today and all over the weekend and almost since the beginning of the week has really been a special privilege for me. I mentioned my home group, Skyland. It's very, very important to me. I've been a member of that group for over 20 of my 43 years. And it's the kind of group that I hear about down here. A group that gives our members all opportunities to get our program. That gives us speaker meetings, discussion meetings, meetings on the big book, the whole gamut. It gives us the tradition meeting, and I'm extremely impressed with this meeting. I'll tell you why. I think that I see, as I get around a little bit, not as much as I used to, but as I get around a little bit, I see our people not getting, of course, the sponsorship that we got, that I got. I see them not getting the traditions as I got them. I see them not getting the very core and basics of Alcoholics Anonymous like I got them. But I also see these groups, like these groups down here and many groups in Atlanta and many groups around the South that I know of personally, that we are doing something about that. I want to thank the committee. I have had a relationship in this weekend. All of the men except one, and my wife has been with me, more than I ever have in my life in any meeting. There's about 15 people. Now, most of them I have talked to privately. I'm not going to make a list because if I do, I'm sure going to forget one and I'm in real trouble. But this conference and these people and you have been a special thing for me this weekend. I notice that I am part of the old-timers meeting here at the sponsorship weekend. And so I better do what I always do, and at some point share about what I was like a little bit in a general way, what happened and what I'm like now. I do want to mention first, though, my fellow speakers, Harriet, who is the first lady of Alcoholics Anonymous, along with Eve M. in the South. She did a marvelous job, and I'm grateful to be with you again. Bonnie, one of the most powerful talks, one of the most honest talks that I ever heard. And I think Bonnie is in good shape, and I think the next time you see him, he'll be doing even better. To be in those meetings between Jack and Clancy and Francis, my dear friend who served with me when she was your delegate and I was on the Board of Trustees, all of them, great people, good friends, and done a wonderful job. And let's give all those previous speakers a hand. Thank you. Yeah, it tells me in my big book that we should talk in a general way, share in a general way what I was like, what happened, and what I'm like now. It may be obvious to a few of you that although I have been in the South almost 40 years, that I was born somewhere else. I go back home on a regular basis. I still have relatives, a brother and a sister up there. And people think I talk funny up there. And when I come back to my home and adopted state of Georgia, you know what you call me. But I was born in a town called Fall River, Massachusetts, almost 71 years ago. I was the son, the eldest son of six children. My father was born in Ireland, a very successful guy, came over in the cattle boat and did very, very well. My mother was the most beautiful lady in town. And we had the six kids, everything went, seemed to go pretty well until one day when I was about 10 years old. And I witnessed and couldn't miss it, the forcible taking of my mother out of our home to go to a mental institution with the disease of manic depressive psychosis. Well, it hit me in the gut. I reacted in such a way that I wanted to tuck it in my belly. I couldn't talk about it. I tried to be a good athlete, tried to be a good scholar, tried to do anything so that I wouldn't have to look at it. Incidentally, that experience had nothing to do with my alcoholism. But it was the kind of a thing that scarred me until I got sober in the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. At 15, with this thing all tucked in, one weekend I was on an excursion with three or four other guys. I was 15 and they were 17, 18, and 19, and some wine was passed around. And I got into it. And I had never really drank. I might have had a sneaking sip from one of my father and mother's parties or something. But I got drunk. I drank. I got drunk. I blacked out. I passed out. And I automatically went looking for a drink in the morning. And I got the drink in the morning and I felt better. And for the next 12 years, I never drank any differently, except worse. They say that alcoholism is insidious and progressive. At 18, my second day in Harvard College, a freshman smoker, some booze was passed around. I got into it, of course. And just before I blacked out, my newfound classmates took me back to my room, put me under the shower, trying to sober me up. And all I could remember saying, but I won't use the language that I used then, all I can remember saying is that I was no good. Already at 18, I felt less than. Already at 18, I felt apart from. Already at 18, a long time ago, I was an alcoholic whose life was unmanageable, who couldn't stop drinking, and who was ready for either an alcoholic grave or an institution such as my mother's. At 21, my first time in my beloved Southland, on a beautiful island off the coast of South Carolina called Paris Island. I can see some of you know about the Marine Corps, and some of you know about the Second World War. And I stayed very sober for 10 weeks in boot camp, I want you to know. Of course, you know how much I had to do with that. Eventually, I got out of boot camp. I was one of those people that my captain thought, in spite of my problems, he made me a drill instructor. He said, we've got to send you to OCS in Quantico because we think you have potential. Now, there's nothing really special about that. I think all drunks have potential when they're drinking, maybe, and that potential doesn't take place until we get sober. And sure enough, three or so, 4 months later, they sent me to OCS in Quantico. I loved the Marine Corps. I was imbued with the spirit of it in that war and in that corps. I went into OCS and that was okay, 7 or 8 weeks. I'm about 2 weeks away from getting my first or second lieutenancy. And I got a 72-hour pass to go to Washington. And I went in with two or three of my classmates. And if we started drinking, and the first thing that happened was they left me. I was already bad to drink with. I was bad news. And I woke up 73 hours after that pass started out of a blackout in a park in Washington, D.C. I got finally back over the next day or so. I was busted from the raid I had, and I was sent down to Tent City in North Carolina and then out to Camp Pendleton to go overseas in the 6th Marines during the war. And when I got sober in Alcoholics Anonymous, I looked at that. I wanted that commission more than life itself. I wanted it so bad I could taste it. And I took a drink of booze, and it was all gone. I went overseas, got in a couple of actions, finally came back just as the war was over, had an injury caused from drinking in a bar room overseas, a shoulder thing. The war was over, so I went to Mare Islands Hospital, the naval hospital on the West Coast. And I had lots of liberty. And I was there 40 or 50 days, and I was constantly going out and getting drunk, being arrested by the shore patrol, coming back to see the captain. And my story with the captain was pretty solid. My story was I was having just a couple of beers, Captain, and these swabbies came around, and they started to mouth off about the Marine Corps. He said, "I understand, case dismissed." Unfortunately, I had a few other captains, so that I finally survived. About 2 months later, into that experience, I was discharged from the Marine Corps. I got an honorable discharge. You know how drunks are, how foolish and lucky we are. And I went over the mountains with two of my buddies who had just been discharged, and we got to Reno, Nevada the next day. Now, Reno is known as a divorce capital of the United States, or it was then, but it also is open 24 hours, the bar rooms. And, of course, I started drinking as soon as we got there, and, of course, my friends left me, again being bad to drink. And I woke up in jail the first night. And that morning, I went before the judge, and he looked at me with my ruptured duck, and he said, "Marine, you did a good job. Good luck. Don't get in any more trouble." And the next day, I was before him again. There was a big crowd, and I got a $10 fine. He didn't really recognize me. And I don't know what happened the third day. What are you doing when you're in a blackout and when you're a sick drunk like this guy? But the fourth day, I was before him again, and he was beginning to recognize me. And he said, "Marine, you get over there. I want to talk to you separately when everybody else is gone." He looked mad. I got a lot of fear. I could see myself spending some time, because he was sending people around and sending them off to jail and doing all kinds of terrible things. I was very rum sick too. And anyway, he finally came to me, and he had my papers. Fortunately, they had not gotten lost. And he said, "Marine, you come from a good family. You've had a good education, or most of one." He said, "You're a civilian now. You can't operate like this and expect to survive." And I said, "Yes, Your Honor, you're right." And he said, "I'm going to give you another chance. I'm going to let you go, but you better get on a bus or a plane or something, and you better get on home and get on with your life." Good advice to anybody who is a reasonable person. But a sick and moving drunk like me, I agreed. I turned around. I went back out of there. And I probably went back as far as the back of this room, and then that gnawing desire came in my gut. You all know it, like I needed a drink. And of course, I got a drink as soon as I hit the street. And you know where I was the next morning. It's a long story. The situation finally worked out that the police took me to a train going east about 5 o'clock that afternoon. Already a hopeless drunk. Already the kind of a drunk that Clancy talked about, the kind of a drunk that Barney talked about. And that was a great, great talk last night, and I'll never forget it. The kind of a drunk who is hopeless and helpless. The kind of a drunk who at times will want to stop drinking, but really cannot. The kind of a drunk who needs a miracle. I got home eventually after calling up. My father was still in a state of denial. He felt that I was a victorious United States Marine and that I was just sowing my wild oats. And when I got home, they were a little struck by the fact that how bad I looked. I didn't weigh very much. I certainly didn't look like a victorious United States Marine. I went into a business that was in my family, a family business that would have taken care of me for the rest of my life. And I only lasted 2 to 3 months in my family business. I went out and took a geographical cure. I went out and got a job out in the oil fields, and they finally had to run me out of that town. I finally got back, and after spending money and doing things, my father decided he got some good advice that he was really enabling me. And he shut me off. I had married Elaine in one of those real clear, lucid periods. She took care of me too and let me go after 3 or 4 months of my drinking. And so I wound up on the skid row of the south end of Boston. My father, my money was gone. My wife had put me out properly. And it was just me and booze and skid row. I did the best I could to drink. I did all the things necessary to drink. I found out where formaldehyde was. I still had people that I went to college with that I could hit for 50 or 25 or something. But I was about at the end of the line. One morning, as I'm shuffling around the south end of Boston with a 2 or 3 day growth of beard, I saw this fine looking man, all dressed up, and I recognized him. I had already been, over the period of the previous 2 years, to about 8 or 10 drying out places. I went to one mental hospital, and I went to a farm that catered to drunks getting off the booze. And I was now barred from the farm. I'd been to the Washingtonian to take the aversion therapy treatment. And this guy, Jim, looked at me, and I could see it was not too great a welcome. You see, in those days, as Eddie knows, everybody knew who was drunk and who was sober. We were small bands floating around. And they knew I was drunk, and he knew I had stayed drunk. And he looked at me, and he said, "Joe, you don't look too good today." And I said, "Jim, I feel a little bad, but I'll tell you, if I could get about $50, I think I can work this thing out and get straightened out in the next couple of days." And that's exactly what he did. He laughed and didn't laugh. He sneered, I think. He said, "Joe, here's a buck. Get yourself a shot and a nail." And as I took that buck, and I took it, and it's something that I will never forget, it was something that was another nail, maybe the final one in the coffin of the drunk. As I took that and I staggered around and slipped around to spend that buck, I realized clearly that I was a drunk. My life was unmanageable. I realized that I could not lean on my mother's illness. It wasn't that. and I didn't know what to do. And I had nothing to do with a chain of events of the next few days that just happened. And you and I know about things that just happen. A kid brother who's still living, I have buried the six of us in the family, brothers, all of them. There's only my brother, my number four brother, and my sister who is living. And all of those people that died from mental illness or a combination of mental illness and alcoholism. And me, who was the worst of all as a kid, got the blessings of being in Alcoholics Anonymous. So when we did this, my brother Bill, found out that I was in a certain place around the south end of Boston. It was very easy. And he, to make a long story short, he picked me up. I will never know. I never asked my dad, who I was reconciled to after I got sober. I've never asked him. I don't think he even remembers. It's not a big event in his life, or a big one, but it was in mine. But he must have broken the family rule, or possibly my father let him do it, because he knew that I was on the end of the line. And he picked me up in the south end of Boston. I got him to get me a pint. We drove around, and as it got to be dusk, we stopped at the Washingtonian Hospital. Now, the Washingtonian Hospital was the last one, the vestige of the Washingtonian movement of 100 years before, where 400,000 or 500,000 drunks got sober over a period of 5 to 10 years. But I was barred from there. I had taken that cure, and I had told everybody in the Boston area what a racket it was. And so the doctor was mad at me. So I was barred. But we came by there at 6 o'clock, and I was feeling pretty good. I'd gotten that pint. And sure enough, we went in the Washingtonian, and sure enough, the doctor was gone. And the lady took my brother's money, and I went down the chute. And to stand here this morning and to share with you that is the last drink that I have ever had since that time is to give you some idea, at least in my life, of the miracle of my sobriety, my beginning sobriety. He came in the next day, the doctor, and was very mad, I understand, but I was already under good paraldehyde and I was moving nicely. About 3 or 4 days later, he let me come upstairs, they let me make a phone call, and I called Elaine. She and I don't really remember the contents of that call. But the contents was that I wanted to get sober, and she was willing for me to come home for a couple of days to give me a starting place to get sober. And I am still there, or she is still here. Thank God. She came in the following Monday, and she was shocked. She hadn't seen me in five or six or seven months. I weighed about 120 pounds. I had a big overcoat that my father had given me. It was about three times too big. I was shaved. I had just been given a mammoth pill by the doctor. I'll never know why. I don't know whether he was trying to knock me out to keep me or what. But so I was goofy. As you can see, we got on home, and I felt a little better, although I remember being nervous about her driving. Me, nervous about them. We sat down, had a cup of coffee, and I called a fellow that Eddie knows, a guy named Arthur D. Arthur D. then, in 1949, was 10 years sober. He got sober in 1939. When Patty Keegan brought AA to Boston, Arthur got sober. And he was one of those people that we don't have anymore. Arthur was the big man in AA. Arthur was the guy. We don't have that anymore. We have a major fellowship with a lot of people, and we're all in this together. But Arthur was special in those days, in those early days in Boston. So he came over, and he was a burly guy, about 50 years old, 55, tough as nails. He had kind of tough love that was, covered up quite well. You had to know him quite a while in order to find it. He looked at me and he said, "Phelan, I understand you want to get sober." After Elaine had given him a cup of coffee, I said, "Yes, Arthur, I do." And I looked at him in the eye, maybe for the first time looking at somebody in the eye for a long time. He says, "All right, kid, get in the car. I'm not going to carry the message to you. I'm going to take you to the message." And we got in the car and he didn't say a word. We drove 30 miles, 35 miles and went to the Woburn, Mass. Men's Group. Now, the only way for me to describe my original home group is to share with you that many years ago, 10, 12, 15, I was in a conference in New Hampshire that had a lot of Massachusetts people there. And I mentioned that I had gotten sober in the Woburn, Mass. Group. And they all groaned. It was a group full of tough love. We approached the man's house, who was the founder of that group, a dentist, Dr. F. And Dr. F. Said, "Arthur, good to see you." And he says, "I guess this is Joe." And he said, "Already had some communication." And I said, "Yes, doctor, I'm Joe." He says, "Well, we've heard about you." Even though I was only a young guy, I was about 27 then, not quite. These small groups and bands, everybody knew who was doing what. And he says, "Well, I'm glad to see you. We're glad to see you, Joe." And he had another fine-looking man next to him. I was running into these fine-looking men fairly regularly because I wasn't like that anymore. And he says, "This is Hunt." And Eddie knows him, too. Dr. Flaherty says, "Joe, I want you to meet Hunt." He says, "Joe, Hunt is your sponsor. I'm not in the hall yet. I'm not in the room. And I have been assigned a sponsor." And this guy was a marvelous guy. This guy, for 4 years, was my father confessor, my sponsor, my leader. He was a guy that brought me out of the woods one day at a time. And yet, if you called his lovely wife, because I know I've heard about this, what was the relationship between Hunt and Joe? She maintains, and Hunt is gone now about 10 years, and I stayed in touch with him all the way. She maintains that Joe saved Hunt's life. And isn't that the way sponsorship works? The guy, the sponsor, sometimes gets more than the sponsee, or they both get plenty together. And I started that trip that leads me here to this fifth sponsorship weekend. This was an all-men's group. It was a tough love group. I needed tough love. I needed a strong direction. I took it, because within no time at all, I recognized that I was powerless over alcohol. I had my record to look at that I could remember. I realized that I needed somebody to take over my life. I did an early first, second, third, fourth, and fifth steps. I was what they called in those days ready. It didn't bother me that I was the only young person around Boston at that time. It didn't bother me that my peers were out getting married and having kids. I was by all that. I was beaten, I was broken, I had tried, and I had failed to live in such a way as I could live. I was very goofy early on. And about 2 months into my not drinking, and my not drinking was very controlled. Hunt would take me to meetings twice a week, sometimes three times. I had a little job by the side of the road picking up leaves. My wife would take me out there with a basket for lunch. At 4 o'clock, she would pick me up. We'd have a bite to eat, and then Hunt would come by. I had a very controlled, and I don't know whether they did it on purpose, but I had that kind of an existence the first couple of months. I heard the stuff, I felt the strength of AA, but I really didn't hear too well. And one night, 2 months into my not drinking, I got in the car, and I had had the kind of a day that I had not had in that first 60 days of sobriety. I was irritable, and I was discontented. I felt like I was going to take a drink. And I told Arthur about it. Thank God. I told Hunt about it, my sponsor. And he didn't say anything, and we went to the meeting, and then he left quick, and they started the meeting, and the meeting was on the young drunk who feels jiggy after 2 months in Alcoholics Anonymous. I was the star, and boy, did they level at me. And I was guiltless. I didn't have it yet. And I got one of those desires to start drinking after 2 months. I didn't really have anything because the head hadn't been able to take it. And it went around the room, and finally a guy said, "Why do you think, Joe, you feel like this?" And I said, "I must be one of those 90-day wonders, thinking about the service and so on." I said, "Maybe I'm one of those guys." And then it dawned on him. They said, "Joe, hear us good. We stay sober one day at a time." I had heard that 100 times in those 2 months, but I never heard it at all until that night. I think that's called selective hearing, and I'm sure none of you have ever been afflicted with it. But I heard it that night, and I have never forgotten it. I was excited. The next day, in my little job by the side of the road, I got a little feeling. And that feeling said, "Joe, you can stay sober one day at a time." And I was off and running. I've now felt at that point that I could stay sober one day at a time. And I did that. And later on, when I was allowed to drive the family car, I went to other meetings. Hunt was one of those guys that explained my mother's illness. He explained it to me very clearly, very early. I realized she was sick, and I had the greatest kind of a relationship with my mother until her death 20 years ago, since I got sober. We had a marvelous relationship, and she was so happy that I was in Alcoholics Anonymous. And she used to come home quite a bit, too. And it was just something great. My dad really didn't believe that I was really sober until I was sober about 5 years. And then we reconciled, and we were able to do something big for him and the family. And we had the greatest kind of a relationship, as generally can happen as you recover in Alcoholics Anonymous. I finally got a job in Boston, about a year sober, in the finance business, which was the business of my choice. I had tried a few of them, but they don't let you get hired if they don't keep you on very long if you work a week and then suddenly you disappear. But I wanted that. I liked that business, and I told the guy, the boss, exactly my story. And he said, "That's all right, Joe. We know about AA, and we know about you, and you come to work." About 3 months into that job, I was out making my calls, and I called in, and the boss said, "Come on in, Joe. There's somebody from Chicago that wants to talk to you." Well, Chicago was the home office of this major finance company. And sure enough, this big, tall guy, Jack was the president of the company, and he wanted to see me. He said, I heard about you from when you were hired, and but I've got a little problem, Joe. Our bonding company will not bond you. They have picked up over 50 arrests in the United States. He said, all of them have been drunk and disorderly. There has been no stealing money. There's nothing like that. But you've been arrested almost in every state in the union drinking booze. And I said, yeah, I know, but I'm trying to do something about that. And I'm sober a year and 3 months. And he said, you got a couple of kids too? And I said, yeah, I got one. I got another one coming. He said, I'll tell you what I'm going to do, kid. You're going to keep your job. We will finance your situation from the bonding company. We will bond you ourselves as a company. He says, you go ahead out and continue your business, and we'll be with you. And I said, thank you, and I went out and I bawled like a baby. It was the first real job that I had. We had a couple of kids. Elaine and I used to have children the first 4 or 5 years like raindrops. My mother-in-law used to worry tremendously as they started to grow. We got 5 kids and 10 grandkids. And that boss, the one in Boston, was the guy who called me up 4 years into my sobriety with a job to run an office. An office of my very own with $300,000 or $400,000 in cash in it, in Atlanta, and that's how we came to Atlanta. I looked around Atlanta when I got there, and there were 4 or 5 meetings a week. Today, there's 1,005 meetings every week. I have had a view of Alcoholics Anonymous's growth right in front of my very eyes. I made a major mistake that Yankees sometimes make in coming to the South and other people make. I looked around and I didn't think that they were working with the big book very well. So I went to the 5 meetings with my big book and discussed it with them. I became the least popular member of Alcoholics Anonymous immediately. Thank God, a great lady, the first delegate from Georgia, Neely Daniel, took up my case. She was my service sponsor, and I see Harriet nodding. Harriet knew her well. She was a great lady. She was in panel 2, and she said, just give this boy a chance. He's sober, and he's doing well, and they went along with it. And to see the tremendous growth of Atlanta has really been in AA, just been a tremendous, tremendous view. When I got down there, I went to a lot of meetings. See, I always go to meetings. I go to meetings because I love meetings. I go to meetings because if I'm a little off and I go to a meeting, I get better. I don't know how it happens or what I hear, but I get better. I got into the steps deeply. At that time, a year or two into my sobriety, I got one of the great breaks. I no longer had Hunt. Instead, I had Johnny S. Johnny S. got sober in Akron in 1942. Dr. Bob 12 stepped him. He was with a big company, and he came east. I knew him briefly before I got sober, and then he came down to the South. And he had business in Atlanta like a family that he would come and see on a regular basis. And he, for 30 years, was my sponsor. He was one of the great people He told me about Dr. Bob like I know Dr. Bob. He is a man of tremendous humility. Johnny, yes. I remember 3 years ago on Easter Sunday when we buried him. Myself and a couple of my friends in Atlanta went over to his town in Alabama and we buried him. And we heard the man running the funeral, the priest, we heard him say about all the things Johnny had done in that community. Had nothing to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. I knew him like a brother, and I didn't even know. A great man. One of the great men that I have ever met. Today, I still have. I always have a sponsor. I have buried three of them. My fourth sponsor is only in his early 50s. He'll probably outlast me, maybe. He's a guy that I sponsored for 20 years. And now he's sponsoring me, too, and we have the right kind of a relationship, an even-handed relationship. With Johnny, it was different. Johnny was still my teacher. Johnny was my leader. Johnny gave me the kind of stuff that I still have. When I think of a problem, something going awry, I say to myself, then to God as I understand him, what would Johnny say? And I get an answer still. A fantastic relationship. I got very deeply into the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Very deeply. Went to meetings. I was starting to get a little bit ambitious. It's about time. I got 5 kids suddenly. Remember I told you about the raindrops. 5 kids. And I got into the finance business, and I opened my own, and I had a very good result out of that. I started to work very hard with my family, particularly when the kids became 10 or more. They still talk about the meetings they had with the old men. I got out a little bit. I saw and heard people like Bonnie and Chuck and... all the great guys of the past that have gone around the country and shared. And I began to broaden my horizon about Alcoholics Anonymous. There's no question that I love Alcoholics Anonymous. After all, if I do my AA right, my life's okay. And that has been the way for a long time. I have the problem, and I'm sure none of you have it, is that sometimes when I ask God this morning, as I did, to do his will, I take it back at 7:30 after seeing him at 7. But then I have something else. I don't like to be running around feeling lousy. And so what I do is I stop somewhere when I recognize it's happening in a quiet place. And I run the steps by myself, and I know immediately what's wrong. It's usually the third step, where I have taken it back again. And I try to give it back again and go on with my life. To me, this is a continuing way of life. It's a continually correcting and moving. No big deal. Just doing what I am supposed to do. I must always remember how sick I was. I must always know that it is a miracle for me to be here 43 years later, one day at a time, living the kind of a life that I live, feeling the way I do, for the wife, the great ones of all time, who loves me, and who I love very deeply. I have everything in this world. That doesn't mean there are not problems. There are. Let me share for a few moments about God as I understand him. God's important to me. Good Irish Catholic. I, like we had in the meeting, primary purpose with Jack, talked about spiritual awakening, spiritual results. You see, I was one of those guys like Bonnie, like Jack. I had a completely warped view of everything, including my higher power. I thought that they were after me. I thought if I had a bad thought, I was in trouble. And I had lots of bad thoughts. And over a period of time in this fellowship, I was willing to believe in a God. God as I understand him. And this relationship is ongoing. God and I have a relationship. There's no way I would come down here this morning without being on my knees and asking for guidance and for strength to carry our beautiful, simple message in this room. There's no way I will do anything important in my life where I do not bring my leader, my friend, God, as I understand him. Another thing happened to me that had some bearing, a lot of bearing on my life. About 20 years ago, I had never been in the service structure of Alcoholics Anonymous. Between building the, between going to meetings, working with people, being worked with, I had never got to the service structure. And I was elected out of the blue. You know how those elections go? To be the GSR of the Skyland Group, my home group. And then I became a DCM, and I was elected then delegate of Georgia, and I was the state chairman of Georgia. And then I was the chairman of the state committee. And then the General Service Conference in 1985 elected me the Southeastern Regional Trustee. Everybody involved, my home group, my home district, my home assembly, and the General Service Conference of Alcoholics Anonymous, gave me an opportunity to serve this fellowship. And it was a marvelous experience. I'm back now and have been for a couple years where I belong, in my home group, on the sponsorship committee of my home group. But it's been a great experience. And any of you who have not been in service, I urge you to, when your time in life is right, to look at it. I very rarely see anybody in the service structure getting drunk. That's one good reason. I have talked to you about some of the things, all very positive. I want you to know that I am also familiar with pain. Very familiar. I know the pain when I am less than I can be. That is a difficult kind of pain, to be less than I can be. And I have a way to do something about that. I go and I sit down, and I listen to my higher power. I don't talk to him, I listen. I go over the steps. And in no time, I know what I gotta do. And I go out and do it, whatever it takes. It would be a terrible thing for a man like me with the gift that I have been given to have any bad feeling with anybody in my life. I know about forgiveness. I was forgiven so much when I came to AA. The whole world forgave me. And then as time went on, I was able to forgive others. And then later on, that most blessed gift of all, to forgive myself. I know of the pain of losing three brothers. One of them, a beautiful kid named Robert, who was with us for 25 years. My daddy asked us to take him. He was a schizophrenic. He was harmless. But he was sick. And for 25 years, he was with us. And one day, I was in a meeting with a couple of AAs doing some service work, and I got a call from Elaine. And she said, Robert, we just got a call. Robert is dead in his apartment. And we took care of everything, and we had a little memorial service in Atlanta, and then I took him back to his father and his mother and buried him in my home church. And it was a little different. I have lost my dad and my mother. I have lost countless of my friends, my brothers and sisters in Alcoholics Anonymous. But this was even different than anything. I seemed to be boiling up and choking and crying, doing what I had to do. And as I went north on the plane with him in the plane, and then we went to the mass the next day, in the middle of the mass, my higher power said, "Joe, the reason you have been taking this so hard with Robert is that you really are his father. You have taken care of him. You and your lovely wife have taken care of him for 25 years. And when you lose a son or a daughter, that is different. That goes against the usual realm of life." He says, "Don't worry. Robert's in good shape." To think that an animal like me, coming out of the skid row to South End of Boston, could have that kind of an experience is to recognize the power, the glory, the magnificence of Alcoholics Anonymous. Today, our life is good. We have a good rhythm of sobriety. There are problems when you have 5 kids in this society, they're all 30 or 40-something. They got problems. And we have the kind of a relationship. It's free. It's open. We let them live. And we're hearing when they need us. And then we just associate with each other. Most of them are in the South. It's a great, great experience. A long time ago, I ran across in the big book, "Lack of Power Was Our Dilemma." And I forgot it, and I went on, and I did the things that we do, the basics. And so today, I know what the answer is, as long as I do it. For me, it's living one day at a time. It's for a relationship with a God of my own understanding. It's going to meetings. It's working with others. It's being worked with. It's doing some service. And I get a chance once in a while, they'll get me in the back of the room and they might ask me a question. Maybe more than that. It's being self-supporting by my own contributions to the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. That's one of those basics that to me is important. And I realize that these basics, which I started to be given back there 43 years ago, which have stood the test of time and given me sobriety and joy and usefulness, are still the thing, the elements of this fantastic experience called AA. And that's why I am so delighted with the format of this meeting, to have these basics like sponsorship and the home group and a primary purpose given to people who come like me and you, in addition to solid, I hope, AA talk. I know Bill and Bob. I never met either one of them, but I know them. When I was in a hospital about 44 years ago, it was run by Dr. Harry Tebow, one of the great doctors and one of the great early supporters of Alcoholics Anonymous, and Bill's doctor, a beautiful fellow. On one Saturday afternoon, we were put in a bus and we went to Long Island somewhere and we went to a meeting. And I had a lot of problems. I could not listen to anything that was going on in that meeting. When I was in the joint, I was loaded with problems. How am I going to get out and this and that? And so I was in the back and there was this tall, thin fellow and he was talking and I didn't hear anything. Until the very end. And I heard him ask the audience this rhetorical question. He says, many people ask me what I want for Alcoholics Anonymous. And he said, what I want, he stood up, very tall man, and he raised his hand to the sky. And he said, I want a long line of my brothers and sisters going back to the Father. And that man was Bill Wilson, a co-founder of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I knew Dr. Bob because of Johnny, my sponsor, who told me in depth about Bob. And if you want to be truthful, Bob is my real hero, because I've only had at times a passing acquaintance with humility. But I'm working on it. And that's why I love him, because he's my hero. And I think we all got heroes in this fellowship. I want you to know that I love you from the bottom of my heart. Bill said at his last words to us, thank you for your lives. He who gave us so much said, thank you because you're here so we can do this thing. And I say the same thing. Thank you for your life. Dr. Bob said, it all boils down to love and service. And we're getting to know what love is. And we know what service is. And I think that's important. That man knew what he was talking about. In closing, I want to share with you my favorite AA story. It's a story that I heard when I was a young kid in this fellowship, hanging on by my fingernails. And it thrilled me. And I always remember it. It's about the sick drunk, beaten and broken and alone, in an alleyway in a little town in Massachusetts, next door to a drugstore where he could get the only place he could get a pint. The store was about to close. He was broke. He was tapped out. He was on the verge of the DTs. He just was hanging there. And a young guy came around the corner and he spotted him. A young guy in our fellowship. And he went down, he says, Johnny, wait a minute. He came back, went into the drugstore, he got a half pint. We used to be doctors in those days. And he brought the half pint to the sick drunk, and he says, Johnny, here you go. Take this, and it'll help you. And then his higher power must have put a little something in the ear of the AA guy. And he says, Johnny, come on home with me. We get a bath, maybe have a little soup, you got your half pint, and we'll start tomorrow to see if we can get sober. And the sick drunk suddenly, who had nothing, beaten, broken, and alone, particularly alone. Now he's got a friend. He's got a place to go, and he's got a half pint. Not necessarily importance in those orders. And the tears start to drop out of his eye. And he says, God is good. God is good. And here tonight in this sponsorship weekend, I don't know any better way to close this meeting. And to echo the words of that sick drunk long ago. God is good. He's been good to me, a sick drunk. And I'm grateful. Thank you.